William Morrow and Harper Audio present Band of Sisters, a novel by Lauren Willig, performed by Julia Whalen. The real founding members of the Smith College Relief Unit, heroes all. Margaret Ashley, class of 1914, Marion Bennett, class of 1906, Elizabeth H. Bliss, class of 1908, Marjorie Lee Carr, class of 1909, Anne M. Chapin, class of 1904, Elizabeth M. Dana, class of 1904, Ruth Gaines, class of 1901, Harriet Boyd Hawes, class of 1892, Catherine B. Hooper, class of 1911, Ruth Jocelyn, class of 1912, Maud Kelly, Alice E. Levins, class of 1903, Millicent V. Lewis, class of 1907, Lucy O. Mather, class of 1888, Alice Weld Talent, class of 1897, Frances W. Valentine, class of 1902, Marie L. Wolfs, class of 1908, Margaret G. Wood, class of 1912. Chapter 1. Dear Ma and Dad, I know this may come as some surprise, but I've decided to leave my position at Miss Cleary's to join the Smith College expedition to France. Dear Ma and Dad, I hope the boys are well. I have some exciting news to share. I've signed up with the Smith College Relief Unit. We're a group of alumni who mean to sail for France to bring aid to French villagers. I've resigned my position at... Dear Ma and Dad, you may have read in the news about the Smith College Relief Unit. Dear Ma, would it be all right if I joined you all for dinner next Sunday? I'll be in town and would very much like to see everyone. Your loving daughter, Katie. Miss Catherine Moran, class of 1911, to her mother, Mrs. Frances Shaughnessy. July, 1917. New York. It was a very long way down to the wharf from the deck of the SS Rochambeau. Kate hadn't expected the boat to be quite so large. When Mrs. Rutherford had informed them that a packet boat would be carrying the Smith unit across the Atlantic to France, she had pictured a cross between the Staten Island ferry and one of the barges that chugged along the East River, something squat and rectangular and human-sized. Not this behemoth of a ship, taller than a townhouse, giant smokestacks punctuating the sky, crowded with war workers of all description. American ambulance men exchanged war stories with French aviators. Journalists jostled aid workers. Kate felt smaller than small in the midst of it, among all these laughing, shouting groups, families hugging, mothers kissing their sons one last time, champagne corks, of all things, popping, baskets of fruits and bouquets of flowers piled into the arms of overworked porters, already staggering under piles of trunks and bandboxes and goodness only knows what else. It felt more like Smith graduation than an embarkation. Well, she hadn't really expected them to come, had she? Her mother had made her disapproval clear. "Have you run mad?" was a phrase that didn't leave itself open to much misinterpretation. There were lifeboats all around, swung out in the ready position in case of need. On the walls, strongly worded notices forbade such dangerous activities as smoking after blackout once they reached the war zone. Blackout. War zone. Maybe her mother was right. Maybe she had run mad. Blame the day. That July day that had been hotter than hot, her room in the boarding house sweltering, the stupider than usual student who had come to her for tutoring in French, the sweat dripping down the back of her neck making her itchy and irritable. At that moment, any place in the world had seemed preferable to where she was, to that horrible, stultifying room that stank of cabbage, the brainless debutantes she had elected to teach in what had been meant to be a temporary position, but had become 6 years of mindless drudgery. Kate hadn't cared terribly much about the cause itself, but the idea that someone would pay her way, there were funds, Emmy assured her, it wouldn't be charity, nothing like charity, to go abroad had seemed too good a chance to miss. We need you, Kate, Emmy had pleaded, and she'd allowed herself to be persuaded, less from charity than from desperation, desperation to be anywhere other than where she was. She knew it was madness in her mother's eyes. Here she was, with a good position, a respectable position, a teacher at a private girls' school. She would never have to scrub floors and empty chamber pots as her mother had, never have to wear a white cap and lower her eyes and curtsy to her betters as they swept past her, making dark prints on a floor she had just cleaned. She had gone off to Smith, and look what had happened. Her mother hadn't said that, not precisely, but it was there between them, there in all the things they never said, there in Kate's clothes, her accent, the way her dad, not her father, always her dad, the man her mother had married when she was 9, kind, always kind, but not her father, never her father, called her our college girl. They were proud, yes, but also wary. She'd become a thing apart. Or maybe she always had been. Kate was the one relic of her mother's first marriage. You could stick a ring in a drawer, but flesh and blood was harder to hide, especially flesh and blood that was old enough to remember and to mind that her past was being scrubbed away like chalk from a board. The early years, when her father had driven the cart for the brewery and come home smelling of beer and horse to tell long stories in his heavily accented English. And after that, the lean years, when she and her mother had been all in all to each other, sharing a bed in the one-room apartment where the radiators never worked and the water came out brown, where her mother scrubbed the stairs in exchange for the roof over their heads, where they ate bread and dripping for supper and pretended it was all they wanted. It had been hard, but they had been together. They had been themselves. But then had come Frank Shaughnessy, member of the Ancient Order of Hibernians, one of Brooklyn's finest, a good man, a steady man, a policeman. Her mother had put cotton gloves over her reddened hands. There had been meat in the stew and sweet-smelling things in the kitchen and 4 little brothers, one after the other, each louder than the last. Kate had spent more and more time in the local library, reading her way around the shelves as the light shifted with her, the first one there after school, the last one out at dusk. Her parents might blame Smith for making her a stranger, but it had all happened long before Smith. She'd been a shadow on the edge of their life well before she'd won the scholarship that took her to Northampton. The one time Kate tried to go back, after Smith, after that summer with Emmy in Newport, well, suffice it to say, it hadn't been a success. It wasn't that there hadn't been room for her. They'd made room, even though it was tight in that 2-family house with her 4 brothers all crammed into 1 room. But they hadn't known what to do with her, or she with them. The men her stepfather had brought home to meet her, boys from the force or the sons of friends, had called her Miss and treated her like someone's maiden aunt. Or they'd been defensive, belligerent, as though daring her to look down on them. No, it hadn't been a success. That was when Kate had found the job at Miss Cleary's School for Young Ladies, which hadn't been a success either, but had at least paid a wage, because if there was one thing that month at home had taught her, it was that she couldn't go home again, not really. But she hadn't anywhere else to go either. Oh, hello, are you one of us? A woman bumped into Kate and gave her a long look up and down. Given that she was wearing the same distinctive uniform, Kate rather thought the question answered itself. You weren't at the luncheon, were you? I would have known you then. I'm Maud Randolph, class of 09. Kate held out her hand. Kate Moran, class of 11. Moran? Do you mean Warren? No, Moran. It was really Moranchik, but the gatekeepers at Ellis Island, confounded by her father's excess of consonants, had, in a stroke, turned him from Yuri Moranchik to Jerry Moran. He had made a most unconvincing Jerry Moran. Kate had been only 5 when he had died, but she could still remember his thick Bohemian accent, the way he pronounced his B's as P's. I know some Warrens in Montclair, offered Maud. Why weren't you at the luncheon? Everyone was meant to be at the luncheon. Kate felt as though she'd been caught sneaking in after curfew. I was a late addition. Emmy Van Alden told me you were short a chauffeur, and, well, here we are. Van Alden? Maud, who had been looking over her shoulder, searching for more interesting prey, turned her full attention back on Kate at the sound of that magic name. Oh, you drive? So does my friend Liza. I don't, but I'm rather a dab hand at French, so I imagine we'll get by. Liza, come meet Miss Warren! Moran, said Kate, without much hope. Straightening her hat, Maud asked, with false casualness, Do you know them well, the Van Aldens? A bit. Kate had stayed with them for that one summer in Newport, in the house she had learned to call a cottage, even though it was anything but. It was the summer she had learned to drive, the summer she had learned, painfully, just how little she would ever belong to their world. Emmy and I roomed together at Smith. Of course, my family knows her family. Well, slightly. Not to speak to, really, but we move in the same circles. My father's law firm handles some of their legal work. Maud flapped an arm at another girl who was attempting to press a large bouquet on an already overladen porter. Have you met Liza Shaw? Liza, come meet! Catherine Moran, said Kate, resigned to repeating her name for the foreseeable future. It felt like freshman year all over again, milling about, trying to keep track of people's names, liking some people on site, and disliking others. Class of 11.
Liza Shaw, class of 09.
Hurrying up to them, Liza said breathlessly,
Maud, there's another bouquet for you, from Harry. I've had them put it in the cabin.
That's 2 bouquets from Harry, said Maud with satisfaction, and a basket of fruit. Although those pears are so terribly hard, I don't know what he thinks we mean to do with them. Fling them at submarines? Liza swiped at a lock of blonde hair that clung damply to her cheek. She had a Dutch doll sort of prettiness, all red cheeks and slightly bulging blue eyes.
Well, yes, but if we leave them out to ripen...
Where? Have you seen the cabin yet? I swear, the black hole of Calcutta has nothing on it. To Kate, she said... Are you rooming with Miss Van Alden? Yes, and with a Miss Cooper. I haven't met her yet. Class of 14. She seems nice enough. You really ought to have gone to the luncheon, you know. It was terribly inspiring.
We're going to have a killing time, put in Liza. I mean, it seems like a very good group.
Except that doctor woman. Maud gave an exaggerated shudder. So mannish. Have you met them yet? There are 2 of them, a senior doctor and a junior one. The junior one's all right, at least her hat was very pretty, but the older one, I half expected her to try to worm me on the spot. I swear, I saw castor oil and carbolic in her eyes.
We met them all at the luncheon,
put in Liza helpfully. Yes, I got that. Kate was beginning to feel as though she'd turned up at an examination, having missed the first month of classes. She hated coming in at a disadvantage. She hadn't even known there had been a luncheon. Emmy had come to beg her to join after the unit had already been assembled, to fill a gap made by someone's leaving. She was, as usual, an add-on, an afterthought. What made you decide to join up? Maud waved her hand in a way calculated to show the engagement ring placed carefully over her glove. Oh, Harry's unit is sure to be sent to France. Harry and I were just engaged this spring, and I heard they're not giving wives passes anymore, so this way I get over there on my own. And it's only for 6 months, so how bad can it be? With any luck, we'll have some time in Paris before we go wherever it is we're going. I promised my mother I'd shop for my trousseau. Won't they be rather short of everything? Paris, said Maud, as though that explained everything.
Oh, is that your old nanny come to see you off? That woman over there, she seems to be trying to get your attention.
Where? Following Maud's careless gesture, Kate saw a familiar hat at the base of the gangplank, her mother's very best hat, the one she wore to baptisms and wakes. Her mother was trying to push her way through the mass of humanity streaming down and away from the boat. A porter stopped her, pointing her away.
Poor thing. That was the last whistle. Didn't you hear it? They'll never let her on now. Still, it was sweet of her, wasn't it?
Maud's voice buzzed in Kate's ear. Kate rose on her tiptoes and tried to wave, but her mother was remonstrating with the porter and didn't see that Kate had seen her. She'd come despite it all, and they were turning her away.
They never do realize we've grown up, do they, these old nannies? Mine still comes from time to time and tries to wipe the cookie crumbs off my face.
The porter was quite firm. Kate's mother shrugged and turned, looking back over her shoulder at the boat. Could she see her? Or was Kate too small a speck, way up high on deck? If she could just get down to the gangplank. Kate looked distractedly at Maud.
Would you excuse me? I must...
They're putting the gangplank up now.
Oh dear, look at that frantic man. Like a picture of the guilty swain, don't you think?
But that collar, and did you ever see such a gaudy bouquet? I wonder who it could be for.
Not that it matters now. He's too late, poor man.
Too late. Kate strained to see through the crowd, to try to catch one last glimpse. It was a scrum down there, all the visitors who had been shooed off the boat milling about, getting in each other's way. Her mother, never tall, was impossible to spot, was probably already halfway back to the L. Had she come to give Kate her blessing? Kate would never know now. She craned her neck, but it was hopeless. She could have wept with frustration. Why did it always have to be this way, always just missing each other?
Oh, there's Harry,
announced Maud, waving wildly. To Kate, she said graciously,
I'm sorry you missed your nanny.
That wasn't my nanny. Kate opened her mouth to say it. She meant to, truly. But Maud poked Kate in the arm, hard.
Oh, there's your friend, Miss Van Alden. Yoo-hoo, Miss Van Alden, so good to see you.
Kate bit her lip, knowing she should say something, should correct Maud, but Emmy was already upon them, dispensing goodwill and dropped hairpins with equal abandon.
Oh, how nice to see you again, Miss. Isn't it lovely to be here?
Kate could tell Emmy hadn't the slightest idea who Maud was, but Kate knew Emmy would never hurt Maud's feelings by saying so.
Kate!
Emmy folded Kate in a hug that smelled like their room at Smith, lavender sachets and cocoa powder and Pears soap.
You're here. You'll have to come see our cabin. I've given you the bed by the window, but the steward tells me it will be awfully hot with all the portholes closed, so we might want to sleep on deck tonight.
Emmy's hair, that indeterminate color between blonde and brown that looks gray in the wrong light, was already frizzing out of its pins, frothing around her face. She shook the strands out of her eyes, like a horse shaking its mane.
You're losing your pins, said Kate, sticking one back in for her.
I know, said Emmy ruefully. I expect I'll be entirely shed of them by the time we get to France and have to wear my hair in a long tail, and all the Frenchmen will make mock of me.
Mock mothers from their sons, mock castles down, said Kate,
without thinking, slipping back years in a moment. They'd put on Henry V together their junior year, bit parts both, but the dialogue had become part of their personal lexicon. Any use of the word mock meant an immediate recitation of the tennis ball speech.
What are you on about? Demanded Maud.
It was our junior play,
offered Emmy in her conciliatory way.
Henry V, the tennis ball speech.
A very long time ago, said Kate, before Maud could ask her if she played tennis.
It felt like a different lifetime, back when she and Emmy had been inseparable, back when Kate still thought she was one of them, could be one of them, back before Newport. How do you like the latest charity case? So long ago, but those casual words still stung.
Maud asked Emmy, just a little too avidly, "Did your people come to see you off?"
"My father and three of my brothers came. That's why I was so long, Kate, or I would have found you sooner."
Emmy was unconsciously twisting her handkerchief between her fingers, as she used to at Smith when she had to do a recitation.
"My mother wasn't able. There were so many meetings, you know how it is, so many committees. But she sent a basket, all full of woolens and wooden toys for the children, and my father brought sherry and crackers."
"What kind of crackers?"
asked Liza with interest.
"DeWitt's, I think," said Emmy. "There's also a 20-pound box of Bailey's candy and some other things. My father said he'd rather thought we would need them, off in no man's land. He was only joking, of course."
"We're hardly going into the trenches," protested Maud.
"Oh, no, he means it as a joke, really. He says he feels quite small in the face of our nerve."
Emmy paused, looking a bit uncertain.
"And it is marvelous, isn't it, to be going abroad and doing something about this horrible war?"
Or about one's trousseau, thought Kate, but didn't say it. Emmy had assured her that there had been an extensive vetting process for applicants, including a written questionnaire, reference letters, and a doctor's note. Perhaps Maud had been a mistake. Or perhaps the mistake was Kate's, letting herself get swept up in one of Emmy's schemes after all these years when she was old enough to know better. Debutante nonsense, her mother called it. Good enough for those that don't have to worry about getting their living. But this was work, too. She might not be paid for it, not exactly, but the unit was covering her room and board, and how else was she ever to see France, even a France at war?
"But I nearly forgot."
Emmy gave her head a little shake, losing another pin in the process.
"Mrs. Rutherford asked me to help gather everyone together. We're to meet in the saloon. I'm meant to be chivying everyone. Shall we?"
"We haven't much choice, have we?" said Kate. "Unless we mean to swim to shore." She'd meant it as a joke, but it came out a little flat. Maud looked at her just a little too hard, with those bright eyes that saw too much.
"I didn't bring my bathing costume," said Emmy, bravely making a joke of it. "And I don't think this uniform would hold up awfully well in the water, do you?"
Kate grimaced at her uniform. "I don't know. It seems pretty indestructible."
"Just like us."
Emmy grabbed Kate's hand, just a little too hard.
"Let's go before we miss anything."
"Did you know nearly everyone on the boat is concerned with the war in some way?"
Maud angled in between Emmy and Kate as they hurried to the saloon.
"I hear there's a whole unit of ambulance men on the boat, and also one of engineers."
"Don't forget the aviators,"
added Liza, puffing along behind them.
"Did you know Nick Peniston's gone for an aviator?"
said Emmy to Kate. "Really?" said Kate, as though she hadn't seen the articles in the papers. "Millionaire's son takes to the sky," as if she hadn't stared at the grainy features half indistinguishable in the newsprint, cursing herself for a fool. He'd been kind to her, that was all. Sometimes the girl who got to go to the ball wasn't Cinderella at all. Sometimes, when midnight chimed, the prince didn't bother to give chase. She wasn't a princess in disguise. As far as the people in Emmy's world were concerned, she was just another Bridget, Irish, Catholic, and poor.
"The president of Andover is here, too," said Maud importantly. "We met him in Montclair last year, didn't we, Liza? He's frightfully nice. Do you know him? And there's Dr. Dennison of Boston College, and the president of a university somewhere in Oregon, goodness only knows, but they say he's up for the presidency of Smith, so I suppose we oughtn't to dismiss him. Oh, there are the ambulance men. Hello!
Those two tall ones seem rather nice." As Maud waggled her fingers at them, one of the ambulance men elbowed his friend, pointing to them.
"What are those?"
"Women, Hank,"
drawled the second man, taking a slug from a flask with Harvard's Veritas emblazoned on it and handing it to his friend.
"They're women."
"No, but what are they doing here?"
The second man shrugged.
"They tell me it's a unit from Smith College."
"College girls?"
Hank choked on whatever was in the flask and had to be pounded on the back.
"Do you think they'll send a platoon from Radcliffe?"
"I'd like one from Gimble's," quipped the second man, snagging the flask. Kate felt two patches of color high in her cheeks. She resisted the urge to stamp on their feet in passing.
Harvard men, said Emmy, whose family had all gone to Yale.
They think we're a joke.
It would help if she didn't feel so much like a joke. The uniforms, which had been designed especially for the Smith unit, were a cross between the military and the archaeological, crammed with pockets wherever a pocket could be put, an embarrassing display of utility. Kate's was too big on her, which made it even worse. It had been tailored for the girl who had left, who had been built on hardier lines. Kate was, like her mother, short and small-boned, easy to overlook.
We just have to show them otherwise, then, said Emmy bravely. That's what my mother would say.
And when Mrs. Livingston Van Alden spoke, people listened. If they didn't, she chained herself to railings, or invited senators to tea and harangued them, or both. Neither of these skills seemed quite applicable to their current situation. Mrs. Rutherford's voice boomed out over the crowd.
Smith unit, to me!
The founder of their unit was 5 feet tall in her buttoned boots, but there wasn't anything else small about her. Her voice made the smokestack shake. She was an archaeologist by profession, which was probably why, thought Kate, their uniforms looked suspiciously like the chosen attire of that much-photographed archaeologist, Amelia Peabody Emerson. Mrs. Rutherford waved an umbrella in their general direction, using it as a prod to herd the slower women into the saloon.
Everyone here? Good.
Kate knew there were only 18 in the unit, but the room felt very full of gray uniforms, with their symbolic touch of French blue. Some of the faces looked vaguely familiar, but hairstyles and clothing changed, and features blurred over a decade's distance. Except one. One woman she would have known anywhere. Kate stopped where she was, her hand on Emmy's arm.
You didn't tell me your cousin would be here.
Didn't I? Said Emmy vaguely. She's a doctor now, you know.
No, I didn't know.
The one in the pretty hat, Maud had said. It wasn't pretty, that wasn't the word for it. It was elegant. Julia couldn't be anything but elegant if she tried. It was in her bones, her bearing. The fair hair that looked so drab on Emmy was golden on Julia. Julia had the same long bones, but not the buck teeth. Put her in a toga and she'd fit right in on any cameo or group of classical statuary, perfectly carved of marble and just about as warm. Kate had never been quite sure whether Julia deliberately set out to make her feel like a worm or whether that was merely a byproduct. Julia, sitting next to Nick on the stairs in Newport, her golden head next to his. How do you like the latest charity case? Kate tried to smile at her, but succeeded only in producing a grimace. On the plus side, Julia looked just about as delighted to see her as she was to see Julia. Those bluer-than-blue eyes narrowed. She looked like a cat who had discovered she'd been given tainted cream. Kate could feel the boat moving beneath her and stilled a tiny flare of panic. 6 months. She'd signed up for 6 months of this. Mrs. Rutherford stepped into the center of the room, blotting out Julia's perfect countenance. Instinctively, the women all fanned out around her, creating a circle, private conversations ceasing.
Welcome, girls, welcome. Welcome to our floating home for the next fortnight as we set out on our grand endeavor.
One of the girls started to clap and then flushed when she realized no one else was doing the same. Mrs. Rutherford smiled kindly at her.
Well, may you applaud. You have all, by virtue of your very presence, signaled your courage and your kindness, your willingness to sacrifice your own convenience to the good of others.
Her voice dropped, and she looked around the room, her eyes meeting those of each woman in turn.
There have been many who have asked me how I can leave my own children to the care of others while we travel abroad on our great work, but all is well with my children. There are other children with whom all is not well, and they too are precious in the sight of God.
It felt like sacrilege to breathe. Outside the room, the noises of the ship went on, but inside the saloon, all was hushed expectancy.
There are women and children in France who have been forgotten, women and children who need us. You ask me what we can do, and I tell you, everything. If they need food, we will help them plant it. If they need shelter, we will find the means to put it over their heads. We will build schools for their children and find beds for the weary. But most of all, the most valuable gift we bring is letting them know they have not been forgotten. As the men wage war, as the guns fire, we remember. We remember them. We remember they are not just statistics, so many left homeless, so many lost. They are people like us, like our families, and we remember them.
Kate could feel the words like an electric current running through her. She could feel herself standing straighter. Mrs. Rutherford seemed to speak directly to each one of them.
You have it in you to make children smile again. You have it in you to mete out goodness to those who for the past 3 years have known only cruelty. Look inside yourself and know that you have it in you to make all the difference to those who have been abandoned by the world, who have lost their families, their homes, their hope. You are their hope.
Nobody spoke. Nobody moved. Mrs. Rutherford smiled at them, a crooked, sisterly smile.
I won't mislead you. Our path is not without pitfalls. We are on probation, all of us. They doubt us, just as they once doubted that women were worthy of an education.
An excited murmur ran around the room.
The Red Cross didn't believe we would be worth the bother. The American Fund for French Wounded has sponsored us, but only for a time. We must earn our welcome. It falls to us, to each and every one of us, to prove them wrong and show them that there is nothing that an American college girl cannot do.
Hear, hear,
cried the girl who had clapped, and this time no one reproved her. Kate found herself alarmingly inclined to cheer. She knew it was all rhetoric. It was all rhetoric, wasn't it? There hadn't been a word of specifics in it. But she still felt like standing up and charging the barricades. Inspiring, Maud had called their director. Well, she was right in that. Kate felt like the snake once the charmer had got through with it. It made her wary. Emmy didn't seem to have any such reserve.
Isn't she wonderful?
She whispered. On the other side of the room, Julia's beautiful face was still and watchful.
Now, back to the practicalities, said Mrs. Rutherford. We are almost all present. Our agriculturalist, Miss Lewes, has responsibilities at the Department of Agriculture, which will keep her through the fall. She will be joining us as soon as she can get away.
Agriculturalist?
Echoed Liza.
To help us with the chickens, said Mrs. Rutherford briskly. We have an addition to our group since we last met. Miss Moran, if you would make yourself known.
Reluctantly, Kate stepped forward.
Miss Moran is a member of the class of 1911. She is to be one of our chauffeurs. She is also an accomplished teacher of French.
Mrs. Rutherford looked blandly around the group.
I know there are those among you who could use some reacquaintance with the language. Miss Moran, if you would be so kind as to offer a daily French lesson during our time in transit, your efforts would be much appreciated.
Of course, murmured Kate, since that was what one said, even though she would rather stab herself in the eye with a pocket knife than teach French to anyone ever again. Emmy beamed as though she'd just done something rather clever.
You know our doctors, of course, Dr. Ava Stringfellow.
A middle-aged woman with a strong-featured face and a pair of expressive eyebrows stood up and gave a half-bow.
And Dr. Julia Prine. Please, do try not to fall ill. Their services are not meant for us, but for the people we go to serve.
A couple of the women chuckled. Kate didn't think Mrs. Rutherford had been joking.
I have a little gift for you.
Reaching into one of her multitudinous pockets, Mrs. Rutherford drew out something that jangled and clanked. It resolved itself into a series of chains, each with a metal tag at the end of it.
Miss Baldwin, Miss Cooper, Miss Dawlish, Miss England, Miss Ledbetter, Miss Mills, Miss Moran.
The tag was warm from Mrs. Rutherford's pocket. Kate ran the ball of her thumb against the lightly incised words, the cuts still rough in the metal. K. Moran, S-C-R-U. On the other side, Rue Scribe, Paris.
Miss Patton, Miss Prine, pardon me, Dr. Prine, Miss Randolph, Miss Shaw, Miss Van Alden. Ah, and here is mine.
Mrs. Rutherford fitted her own tag over her head, tucking it neatly beneath her collar.
You must wear your badge at all times. They are not the most beautiful of ornaments, but they are necessary.
But why?
Asked Miss Cooper, the girl who had clapped, looking up from her tag. From the other side of the room, Julia spoke for the first time.
They're to identify our bodies, said Julia in her hard, beautiful voice. When the ship goes down.
Chapter 2. Dear Mother, don't you like the life preservers all over the stationery? It's quite different from the last time we crossed to France together. All the talk is of submarines and lifeboats. But there's really nothing to worry about, they say, so long as we follow the regulations and don't do anything foolish. They've given us tags to hang around our necks with our names on them. Mine says E. Van Alden, S-C-R-U. It's merely a precaution, of course. It makes us feel quite military.
Miss Emmeline Van Alden, class of 1911, to her mother, Mrs. Livingston Van Alden. August 1917. Packet boat SS Rochambeau, somewhere in the Atlantic. Miss Cooper dropped her tag. Everyone stared at Julia, who just shrugged. Don't kill the messenger. It is what it is. Emmy jumped up, her own tag clutched in her hand.
Well, I think it's rather fun to have a keepsake of our time together, a memento.
Some of the women smiled back. Some didn't. No one is drowning, said Kate flatly, not out of conviction, but because if Julia said the sky was blue, Kate would claim it was purple. Emmy had forgotten what it was like mediating between the two of them, or maybe she simply hadn't wanted to remember. There are lifeboats in plenty, and these lovely, bulky life jackets with which they've provided us.
Ah, yes, that's another thing. You need your papers for the lifeboats.
Mrs. Rutherford rustled about among her pile of papers, producing thin slips, which she proceeded to distribute.
You are each assigned to a place in a lifeboat. Please do try to remember to keep your papers on you. You will need to show it to take your seat.
What happens if we haven't our passes or run to the wrong boat?
Asked Miss Cooper, looking worried.
I don't know about you, said Maud, but if the boat is going down, I'm climbing aboard the nearest lifeboat and asking questions later. There's really no need for that sort of thing, said Mrs. Rutherford. As long as everyone follows the protocols, there shouldn't be any confusion.
But wouldn't the ship be tilting?
Asked Miss Cooper, twisting the chain of her tag around and around her fingers.
What if you couldn't get to your lifeboat? I'm sure it's all moot, said Emmy soothingly, looking to Kate to back her up. They have to think of these things, but really we're not at all the sort of ship the Germans want, are we? And they do seem to have thought of everything, haven't they? I'm sure we'll be safe as...
One can be in enemy-infested waters, said Julia. Miss Cooper gave a tremulous smile.
You make it sound like mice.
Mice have their good points, put in Miss Dawlish, 07, the kindergarten teacher. Emmy had been seated next to her at the luncheon and liked her immediately. She had a pleasantly freckled face, her ginger hair braided around and around like a crown. We made pets of them in our classroom. The children built a little cage for them. Maud wafted that aside.
Mice, perhaps, but not Germans. Do you know they say they give you 500 francs and a croix de guerre if you shoot one?
I, for one, mean to get a revolver and pot as many as I can.
Mice? Asked Miss Cooper.
No, Germans, said Maud, rolling her eyes at Liza. They seemed to have rather departed from the high tone of a moment before. Emmy looked to Mrs. Rutherford, wondering when she would take charge, but Mrs. Rutherford was busy with her notes, shuffling through a pile of lists and papers, unconcerned by the sniping among her recruits. In desperation, Emmy clapped her hands together.
Has anyone thought of getting a concert together? A charity concert?
Charity concerts were one thing she knew how to do. As she knew better than anyone, the best way not to think was to keep as busy as possible.
We could hold one for the other passengers. There are an awful lot of people on the ship, aren't there? We could have a concert to raise money for the French wounded. It wouldn't need to be anything elaborate, just a few airs and recitations. Kate, remember Henry V? You could do the St. Crispin's Day speech. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
Wouldn't it be band of sisters? Said Kate wryly, but at least she'd stopped glowering at Julia. Ugh, said Maud. You aren't going to ask us each to do a turn, are you? It would be too embarrassing.
Oh no, we wouldn't want to take over the program. Just organize it, said Emmy,
improvising madly, feeling the mood of the room lightening. There was nothing like a concert for pulling people together. The others were perking up nicely, everyone starting to think what they knew, what they could do.
We could ask those nice Harvard men to sing glees. Maybe you might ask them. I'm sure they would listen to you.
If you think it would be useful, said Maud, but Emmy could tell she was itching to get out there and put her persuasive powers to use. Emmy looked around the circle of women. She didn't know them yet as individuals, but they felt familiar anyway, familiar as Smith women, familiar as all the committee women and settlement house volunteers with whom she had worked over the years, women who had helped her drape bunting and serve hot meals and put on comic operettas. She felt a surge of warmth for them all.
There must be other people on the boat with all sorts of talents. We could put out an open call for performers.
It will have to be before we enter the war zone, Mrs. Rutherford cautioned, looking up from her notes. Once we cross that line, there will be no more music after dark. That will be a week from now.
We could call it One Last Night of Music, suggested Miss Cooper,
and then looked alarmed at her own words.
I mean, not the last night of music forever, just the last night of music on the ship.
Yes, yes. Ava, if you would come with me.
Mrs. Rutherford gathered up her files, gesturing to Dr. Stringfellow, who served as assistant director of the unit as well as their primary medical authority.
And Dr. Prine?
Emmy felt her tension lighten as Julia turned to go. She loved Julia, she did. They were first cousins, practically the same age, except that Julia had been born 6 months earlier, first in that as she was in everything. Emmy had always suspected that she bored and frustrated Julia, but it was hard to tell. Julia kept herself to herself, twisting back her emotions as tightly and adroitly as she did the golden coil of hair at the back of her head, not a strand out of place. Julia's mother, Aunt May, was just the same way. Emmy had always been a little terrified of Aunt May, who lived an exotic, continental existence, returning to New York every so often to drop Julia at the rambling brownstone on East 34th Street to be a sister for Emmeline. And they were sisters, of sorts. Sisters who loved each other, even when they didn't understand each other very well, which was most of the time. Feeling guilty, Emmy called softly,
You will sing at the concert, won't you, Julia? No one has a voice like yours.
Her cousin gave her a curt nod of acknowledgement before following Dr. Stringfellow out of the room. Emmy could feel Kate looking at her.
She means well.
Hmm, said Kate, which was Kate's way of disagreeing entirely.
Come,
said Emmy, hooking her arm through Kate's, feeling obscurely cheered. She knew that, of old. It had been 6 years, but Kate was still the same Kate, and there was something reassuring in that. They said blood was thicker than water, but she had always felt more at home with Kate than with Julia.
even if Julia came of the same Knickerbocker stock and Kate from what her father called those people.
I'll show you our cabin. Don't expect terribly much. It really is pretty dire.
It can't be worse than my room in Boston, said Kate, as Emmy pushed open the door.
I thought it was a very nice room,
lied Emmy, groping her way through the darkness until she bumped into a berth, sitting down with a thump that made the springs squeak. The portholes had been boarded over, casting the cabin into permanent gloom.
It was a dreadful room, said Kate.
And suddenly, they were both laughing, as if they were 18 again and not 28 and on their way to a war zone.
Be grateful it was, or I'd never have agreed to come.
I'm so glad you did, said Emmy honestly. It makes it all feel less
mad, suggested Kate, lowering herself carefully onto her own berth.
Daunting, said Emmy.
They were quiet for a moment, the dark room close around them. Why didn't you ever visit? Emmy wanted to ask. Why didn't you write? They had never stopped being friends. They had simply stopped being friends who saw one another. She had known Kate was busy, that Kate had to get her own living, but she couldn't help feeling a bit hurt all the same. Her mother would have been so happy to help, to give Kate a job as her own secretary. They might have gone on as they had been. But of course, all things changed. Emmy knew that. It had been an impulse that had taken her to Kate's boarding house in Boston. They needed a woman who could drive and who spoke French, and Kate could do both. But that wasn't the real reason. The truth was that she'd wanted Kate there because she'd felt in some obscure way that if Kate were with her, nothing would seem quite so large or terrifying. Kate would make everything all right, just as she had back in their days at Smith, when nothing was so bad it couldn't be cured with hot cocoa brewed on a gas ring.
Do you remember the cocoa parties we used to have?
I doubt there'll be much cocoa in France, said Kate quietly.
You're probably right.
Of course Kate was right. She was simply making a statement. It wasn't a rejection. It was Emmy's own sensitivity that made it feel like one.
I heard someone asking the steward for white sugar. He shrugged and said, "C'est la guerre."
I imagine la guerre covers a multitude of things, said Kate.
Emmy heard the springs squeak as Kate reached up to lift the heavy knot of her hair off the back of her neck.
I take it back. It is even hotter in here than in my room in Boston.
One of the ambulance men was telling me that everyone sleeps on deck, offered Emmy. He said pushing two deck chairs together makes an adequate sort of bed.
Kate grabbed two blankets and handed one to Emmy.
Let's hope it doesn't rain.
It did, of course. Not that night, but the next. The 10 members of the Smith unit who had elected to sleep on deck woke to a deluge and wound up taking themselves, dripping and shivering, into the marble-floored entry hall of the ship, huddling together for warmth.
Have you noticed,
said Miss Cooper in a small voice, hugging her knees to her chest,
that our uniforms smell when they're wet? They do say the war zone is awfully rainy. I imagine we'll get used to it, said Emmy hopefully.
And it saves us having to wash our hair, said Kate dryly, loosing the tie of her braid to fan out the long, wet strands.
Emmy had always envied Kate's hair, a thick, rich chestnut, not all indistinct and flyaway like hers. Kate's hair stayed where she put it.
Have you thought of the lunacy of us all, sitting here shivering when we all have perfectly good beds waiting for us below?
Yes, but it's easier to escape from on deck.
Liza struggled to a sitting position, kicking her legs free of her sodden blanket.
You know they say that the most dangerous time is just at dawn when the sea is quiet and the submarines can see us, but we can't see them.
Lovely, said Kate.
But the ships shouldn't list quite so quickly because all the portholes are closed, said Liza importantly,
thumping the never-sink vest she was using as a pillow.
So that should give us more time to get to the boats.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
The blanket-wrapped lump that was Maud flopped over.
If you can't all be quiet, we might as well go and smother in our cabins. At least that will be a quick death.
Must we talk about death, please?
asked Miss Cooper in a small voice.
Nobody is dying,
said Emmy soothingly. But it was a lie, of course, and they all knew it. In France, 10 days away, 6 days away, 4 days away, men were dying by the thousands, dying every day, dying in mud and blood and unimaginable agony. And they were going there. They had chosen to go there. What had made sense on a spring afternoon in Boston made much less sense at 4 in the morning, huddled under a blanket on the hard floorboards of the deck, listening to the restless pacing of those who couldn't sleep, waiting for the torpedoes to strike. Emmy did her best to keep busy. In the mornings, she joined Kate's French classes, where Liza continued to struggle with subjunctive verbs, and Miss Cooper spoke very carefully in her correct but cautious French. Miss Cooper had brought a little paint set with her, and while Emmy couldn't paint anything more demanding than flowers, and not very interesting flowers at that, she could look and admire, so she admired to the very best of her abilities. In the afternoons, Emmy stood on the deck, waving her arms about over her head and jumping up and down along with Liza, Maud, Miss England, Miss Cooper, and roughly 80 assorted ambulance men, engineers, and YMCA volunteers, as the YMCA physical director led them in a series of setting up exercises designed to get them into fighting shape, or at least scare off any inquisitive seagulls. Miss Dawlish, the kindergarten teacher, could usually be found in the saloon about that time, drinking weak coffee with brown sugar. Emmy made a practice of joining her, still red in the face from calisthenics, to discuss the innovations of the Sloyd method of teaching, of which Emmy knew only a little, but Miss Dawlish was only too happy to enlighten her, her tired face lighting with enthusiasm as she spoke of the education of children through woodwork and handicrafts. In the evenings, Emmy and Kate shared a table with Miss Cooper, Liza, Maud, and the presidents, respectively, of Andover, Boston College, and Reed College, during which they had lively discussions about the advisability of education for women, and Kate got far too much amusement out of the president of Andover's insisting on addressing Maud indulgently as Rosie, no matter how many times Maud corrected him. I can't stand his ideas, Kate admitted, but I do love watching Maud fume.
I wish we had a table together as a unit, said Emmy worriedly, pulling 2 deck chairs together to make a bed.
The chairs themselves weren't that uncomfortable, but it was always awkward at 4 in the morning when the chairs were kicked apart so that the decks could be swabbed. She had tried sleeping directly on the deck instead and woken up with a mop in her face.
I don't like that we haven't got to know each other yet. There are girls I haven't even spoken to.
We'll have plenty of time together over the next 6 months. Why bother with it now? Asked Kate through the ribbon in her teeth as she finished plaiting her hair into its bedtime braid. They slept in their clothes. Those were the rules. Always keep your life vest at hand, never undress. But they allowed themselves the luxury of taking down their hair.
I know, but...
But they were all nervous. There had been an almost holiday air for the first week, with concerts every night, but once they entered the Bay of Biscay, the reality of the war slammed down upon them. No lights after dark, no music, no conversations, no cigarettes. All punishable on pain of arrest and a stint in a French prison. Maud and Liza appointed themselves guardians of the blackout and chased after men with radial watch dials, ordering them to cover their lights. Miss Cooper, Emmy had noticed, kept more and more to herself, writing letters to a friend at home, then crumpling them up again. One of the other women, Miss Patton, who had been a year ahead of Emmy at school, had a little silver flask she took out when she thought no one was looking, and sometimes smelled of sherry when they all huddled together on the deck at night. Mrs. Rutherford was nowhere to be found, closeted in her room with her plans and the doctor's. There was no denying that an undertaking of such magnitude required a great deal of planning. Emmy had seen enough of her mother's grand endeavors to know the intricacies involved, but shouldn't she be paying a bit more attention to the women in her care? Emmy managed to corner Mrs. Rutherford at breakfast, drinking her coffee with one hand while taking notes with the other.
Yes, Miss Van Alden?
Their leader was, Emmy noticed, writing in Greek letters. She rather hoped it was some sort of code, and not because she was working on something to do with the ancients instead.
I wonder, began Emmy, if you might have noticed that everyone seems a bit nervous.
We are entering a war zone, said Mrs. Rutherford practically,
with that disarming smile that made everything seem just as it ought.
We'd be fools not to be nervous.
Well, yes, but that is, I think we'd all feel better if it would be such a useful thing to know what we're to do once we get there.
But didn't I tell you already?
Said Mrs. Rutherford, already half distracted by whatever it was she was writing. Emmy shook her head as hard as she could.
I thought I had. Oh well, if you really think it would be an aid to morale.
Oh, I do, said Emmy fervently. I really do.
Mrs. Rutherford called them together in the saloon the next day.
Our voyage has almost ended, she announced, and I must say I'm very proud of how you all have conducted yourself. Just this morning, Dr. Van Dyke took me aside to tell me how fine he thinks you all are.
Dr. Van Dyke?
Emmy murmured to Kate.
The old goat with the beard and the monocle, Kate whispered back, and Emmy had to suppress a nervous giggle.
You are just the right sort, he said. Not neurasthenic enthusiasts, but with a natural dignity and modesty without prudery.
Neurasthenic?
Wondered Liza.
Barmy,
Maud hissed back, not quite sotto voce. Emmy did her best to look dignified and modest, but wondered just how Dr. Van Dyke would know. Or Mrs. Rutherford, for that matter. Hadn't they seen Miss Patton's sherry flask or Miss Cooper's hunched shoulders? Or maybe they were right, and Emmy was wrong, and this was all completely natural and normal when one was entering a war zone, and not the least, what had he called it? Neurasthenic.
It has been brought to my attention that you might wish to have more information about our intentions.
Mrs. Rutherford tapped the map spread out on a tea table, weighted down with books on four sides.
We shall make our home here, in the village of Graycourt. When the Germans retreated, they laid waste to the surrounding area, and then they sent the villagers home to live in it. Not all the villagers, the fit ones they took with them to Germany. The very young, the very old, the infant, and the infirm. Those are our charges.
Pardon me.
Maud was peering at the map over Mrs. Rutherford's shoulder.
Did you say we'd be here?
She jabbed at the area with a finger.
Yes, said Mrs. Rutherford. That is why it is marked with an X.
But those lines over there
are the front line trenches, said Mrs. Rutherford.
She turned away from Maud.
Now, as I was saying, but we're practically in the trenches.
Actually, said Miss Dawlish helpfully, leaning so close to the map that her nose practically touched the print. If you read the legend, it looks to be about 10 miles away.
9, corrected Mrs. Rutherford briskly. Now, 9?
Maud appeared to be having difficulty speaking.
No one told us we'd be offering aid from the frontline trench. We can hardly help villagers rebuild their lives from Paris, can we?
Said Mrs. Rutherford, in the same tones of exaggerated patience Emmy imagined she used on students who mistranslated Homer. It was a tone Emmy had heard frequently from her own professors in a variety of subjects.
Now, our entire usefulness rests on our ability to travel between the villages. Our first order of operation is to retrieve our trucks. Our chauffeurs will go directly to Brest to fetch the trucks.
She consulted her notes.
Miss Shaw, Miss Patton, Miss Cooper, you'll be in charge of the Ford trucks. Miss Moran, Miss England, you will share responsibility for the white truck.
Kate sat very still, her face dangerously expressionless.
I've never driven a white truck, only a Chalmers touring car.
And I've never driven a Ford,
chimed in Liza. She thought for a moment.
Or a white.
You'll learn, said Mrs. Rutherford,
obviously considering this an entirely irrelevant interruption.
As for the rest of us, we shall be engaged in seeing to our papers and securing the necessities we need to bring to Greycore. We shall need upwards of 60 chickens and at least 4 cows.
Cows? Echoed Maud. Did you say cows?
Or Vash, if one wants to get into the local spirit.
No one did. Mrs. Rutherford sighed.
Cows have one great advantage, Miss Randolph. They create milk. We will have 11 villages in our charge with nearly 2,000 souls relying upon us. There are babies without mothers, children wasting away from want of good, nourishing food. So we shall have cows.
But I've never had anything to do with cows.
Mrs. Rutherford squeezed Maud's shoulder, looking deep into her eyes.
You can do anything you set your mind to. Never let anyone tell you otherwise.
Maud's mouth opened and closed. She looked less like a cow and more like an outraged fish.
I do have some books on animal husbandry for anyone who would like to do some reading. Here is an excellent manual on the keeping of chickens. Miss Randolph, would you care to have it? I believe you will find it most informative.
I'll take it,
said Emmy quickly, since Maud looked about ready to lay an egg in rage.
Excellent.
Mrs. Rutherford turned the full force of her smile on her, and Emmy felt her spirits, inexplicably, lifting.
You shall be in charge of our chickens, Miss Van Alden, until our agriculturalist arrives. Now, is there anything else?
No one dared venture anything else. Mrs. Rutherford cast a benevolent smile in their general direction and drifted out, her ever-present notebook clasped to her side.
I knew I'd be called on to do obstetrical work, commented Julia to no one in particular, but I hadn't expected to turn veterinarian.
That's Betsy for you,
said Dr. Stringfellow, with a certain grim satisfaction. She had, Emmy remembered being told, been Mrs. Rutherford's roommate at Smith back in the 90s.
She'll have us all milking cows and liking it.
Oh, not you, said Maud, too indignant to be politic. You'll be too busy doctoring, but the rest of us.
I hope there aren't goats, said Miss Patton.
Emmy could see her hand go to the pocket where the silver flask was kept, clutching it like a talisman.
I've never gotten on with goats. My grandmother kept goats. They were dreadful.
I wonder if the children would like to help build chicken coops, mused Miss Dawlish.
Maud glared at her.
Well, I think it's insane. Cows and chickens.
She does have a point about the milk, said Liza,
and just as quickly subsided again.
You milk the cows then, said Maud crossly.
I don't think she means us to milk them, said Emmy. I think the villagers are meant to do that. We're simply to procure them and stable them. Does one stable a cow?
No one knew.
My uncle has a farm in Ohio, said Miss England, but I grew up in Cleveland. Our milk came in glass bottles from a little wagon.
Kate laughed, a sharp, bitter laugh.
What a useless bunch we are.
Emmy smiled ruefully at her.
If there were a recital competition, I'm sure we'd be tops.
Well, I don't think we're useless, said Maud. I could be jolly well useful doing something that made any sense. The YMCA director says there's plenty of canteen work and loads that needs doing for the troops. And it has the benefit of not being in the firing line.
I wonder if she has any books on how to drive a Ford,
asked Liza as she followed her friend out of the saloon.
It's going to be a disaster, isn't it? Said Kate.
Emmy tried to remember the way she had felt at the luncheon back in the spring, the luncheon where Mrs. Rutherford had first broached the notion of a Smith College relief unit, the way she had felt just a week ago when they had first been gathered together in this same saloon, the exultation, the certainty. All her life, she had watched as her mother launched one grand scheme after another. Her mother was a born leader. Mrs. Livingston Van Alden was a founding member of the French Union for Women's Suffrage, despite the small impediment of not being French. But she hadn't let that stop her any more than she had let not being British stop her from chaining herself to the railings of Parliament with her great friend Emmeline Pankhurst. She had convinced Alva Vanderbilt to resume speaking to Mrs. Stuyvesant Fish for long enough to invite her to a suffrage conference at Marble House. She had given speeches and organized rallies all around the world, all while giving birth to 7 children and seeing them raised along progressive educational lines. Admittedly, this had been administered in practice by a series of nannies and governesses, but the theory of it had all come directly from Emmy's mother, who had mandated cold baths and Latin verbs with equal enthusiasm. Emmy had been given the sort of education of which her mother had only dreamed. But she was not, her teachers said regretfully, academic by nature. Except when it came to poetry. She did like poetry. But Keats and Lord Tennyson weren't on her mother's list of useful and improving topics. Emmy was meant to be studying the classics and absorbing rhetoric, but she found Greek verbs impenetrable. And every time she got up on a podium, her tongue faltered, although she was rather good at draping bunting. She was meant to be out there, rallying and marching, carrying the flag, motivating and inspiring, the very image of the new woman. Well, her mother's image of the new woman. Instead, she had spent the last 6 years doing settlement house work, warming milk for babies, teaching children their ABCs, making sure the children of the Lower East Side had warm clothes for winter, and that the library of the Girls' Club, for respectable young working women of the less fortunate classes, was stocked with the sorts of books that might appeal to a 12-year-old who had been put to work sewing shirtwaists at the age of 8. Emmy wouldn't miss the chaos of the family brownstone on 34th Street. Well, not much. But she did miss her girls. Some of them came to her so young and so thin, and it was such joy to feed them up and teach them their letters if they didn't know them already, and just give them a quiet, warm place where they could be. There weren't many places where one could just be. It was all very useful work, and Emmy knew, at least she told herself, that it truly did make a difference to the recipients. But nothing to light up the world, nothing to earn her mother's respect. But here, finally, was her chance to do something heroic. If only it didn't all go wrong. "It's this ship," Emmy said, desperately needing Kate to feel as she did, to believe as she did, because if Kate didn't believe, how were they to succeed? It was Kate who had got her through Smith, had kept her from failing her examinations. "It's the waiting that's so hard, being here and not being able to do anything yet." "Yes, but what are we meant to do?" Kate asked practically, "other than collect cows?" "Offer hope to the hopeless," Emmy wanted to say, but somehow the words rolled off better from Mrs. Rutherford's tongue than hers.
"At least we have professional assurance that we're not neurasthenics."
When Kate looked at her skeptically, she added,
"I'm sure it will all make sense once we get there. Everything will be better once we get to Paris."